Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 47. I'm going to do verses 1 through 31, the entire chapter, which I will entitle Jacob's Family Settles in Goshen, the land of Goshen, which is at the northeast of Egypt on the southwest boundary of Israel. Our context is this. In Genesis 46, the whole chapter, we read about Joseph bringing his family to Egypt. If you will call, Jacob sent Judah on ahead. Judah goes down to wherever Joseph was, south of Goshen, south and west of Goshen. And Joseph then comes back and meets Jacob in Goshen, and they have their tearful reunion. So we start now in verses 1 and 2 of Genesis 47. Then Joseph went in and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brothers and their flocks and their herds and all that they have come out of the land of Canaan, and behold, they are in the land of Goshen." He took five men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. So Joseph, having met Jacob and cried and carried on and so forth, then he took five of his brothers and went back to the capital city. We don't know where that capital city is because we don't know which Pharaoh this is. But Joseph goes back to the Pharaoh, bringing five brothers with him. Now, why did Joseph do that? Well, so there would not be any question of the family, his family, trying to sneak across the border, as military spies might create a military danger there. He wants to make sure that everything's copacetic. And he mentions all of the flocks and herds that his father and brothers are bringing with him. That was to show Pharaoh that Joseph's family were not leeches. They were not going to place themselves on the Egyptian dole, if you will. It also shows that they needed pasturage in Goshen. That's why they needed to stay in Goshen, because they had all those flocks and herds. And that's why this was mentioned here, mentioned to Pharaoh by Joseph. Now, the land of Goshen was, as I said, the extreme northeastern end of Egypt on the southwestern border of Canaan. It was fertile because it was watered by the Nile Delta. In fact, it was one of the most fertile areas of Egypt. In verse 2, Joseph takes five men. The question we might ask is, why did he just take all of the brothers? I don't know what the answer to that is. Maybe he needed to leave the rest of the men behind to take care of the women and children. I suspect that has a lot to do with it. Now, verse 2 says Joseph took five men from among his brothers. That seems straightforward enough, but it turns out that the Hebrew, according to Adam Clark in the original, has something strange, is the way he put it. And literally translated, it comes out something like this: from the end or extremity of his brethren, he took five men. Well, what does it mean, from the end or extremity of his brethren? Well, it could be understood in six different ways. He took five brethren at random. He took five of the shabbiest looking brothers, the end of his brothers, so they wouldn't be co-opted for military service. Option number 3, he took five of the handsomest brethren in order to impress Pharaoh. Option number 4, he took five of the youngest brethren. That's option number four. Option number 5, he took five of the eldest brethren. Jameson Foster Brown says that's probably the correct choice, seniority being the least invidious principle of selection. So if Jacob needs to carry somebody to see the Pharaoh, he wants a representative delegation, but he needs to leave some people behind. It makes sense to take five of the oldest brethren. We don't know that. It's reasonable speculation. Or it could just mean five, some from the oldest, some from the youngest, with no particular order. It could just mean some. He took some of the brethren. He took five men from some of his brothers. I don't really care what it is. That's really probably TMI. But anyway, five brothers go down to Pharaoh. We go to Genesis 47, verses 3 through 6. Then Pharaoh said to his brothers, "What is your occupation?" So they said to Pharaoh, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and our fathers." They said to Pharaoh, "We have come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, please let your servants live in the land of Goshen." Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is at your disposal. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Let them live in the land of Goshen. And if you know any capable men among them, then put them in charge of my livestock." Now, when Pharaoh says to the brothers, "What is your occupation?" Joseph had probably already tipped the brothers that Pharaoh would ask this. We read this in the last chapter, Genesis 46, 33 through 34. Jacob is talking to his brothers, and he says, "When Pharaoh addresses you and asks, 'What is your occupation?' you are to say, 'Your servants, both we and our fathers, have raised livestock from our youth until now.' Then you will be allowed to settle in the land of Goshen, since all shepherds are detestable to Egyptians." In other words, tell them you're shepherds so that they'll want to keep you a long way away from the centers of culture in Egypt, where you Hebrew rubes will not be appreciated. You'll be detested. You'll be loathsome in their eyes. So just stay up here in Goshen. So tell the Pharaoh, Jacob tells his brothers, tell the Pharaoh that you're a servant so that the Pharaoh will be glad to put you up there in Goshen. Now, here's a problem. Pharaoh already knew that the brothers wanted to stay in Goshen. We know that from verse 1 that Joseph went in and told Pharaoh, my father and my brothers, et cetera, et cetera, have come out of the land of Canaan and they want to go in the land of Goshen. So Joseph's already told Pharaoh. So why is he asking the brothers straight out? Well, that could just be a formality. He's just making conversation. I think that's probably what it is. John Gill says this was a usual question Pharaoh asked of settlers to make sure he had no vagrants, to see if the settlers could be of any use to his kingdom. And as a matter of fact, he thought they could be of use because they could be shepherds for his flocks. The brothers answer Pharaoh in verse 4, we have come to sojourn in the land of Egypt. Now, what they meant was they planned to stay to live, but they weren't there as leeches just to take grain from the Egyptian granaries. They weren't there to do anything militarily. They were going to live there and become productive citizens. And so when they say in verse 4, we want to live in the land of Goshen, of course, Joseph has probably told them to tell Pharaoh that. Now, Pharaoh says, sure, come on in. You got the best land. As Gill and Clark say, Goshen was the most fertile and fruitful part of Egypt. It was full of pastures because of the Nile and its canals, as Gill says. Now, why was Pharaoh willing to give the best of his land to these loathsome shepherds? Well, because he owed his life and his kingdom to Joseph, not to mention the fact he probably could use some shepherds. The fact that Pharaoh did this shows that Egyptians didn't hate all shepherds, just the ones that cause trouble. But Pharaoh doesn't seem too worried about the reputation of shepherds. He thinks that, hey, Joseph can do no wrong. He's my man. He saved Egypt from famine. I'm sure his relatives will be good shepherds. They're not going to be criminals or anything like that. We go to Genesis 47, 7 through 10. Then Joseph brought his father Jacob and presented him to Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many years have you lived? So Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my sojourning are 130. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my father lived during the days of their sojourning. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. 130 years was considered a few years. Wow, that's nice. Now, in verse 1, I ask myself the question, why did Joseph bring his father Jacob by himself to Pharaoh? Well, that's what it sounds like, but it could be just that he brought Jacob at the same time as he brought the five brothers. It's just the way it sounds, but that's not necessarily what it means. But at any rate, Jacob's there, and first thing Pharaoh says, after Jacob blesses the Pharaoh, first thing Pharaoh says is, how old are you? Pharaoh may have been impressed by Joseph's elderly appearance, by Jacob's elderly appearance. And in verse 9, when Jacob says how old he is, 130 years, he says he describes his years as years of sojourning. In other words, he's wandering around, living the life of a nomad, as he waited for the promise of a land that he could settle down in. He never got it during his lifetime. It was Abraham's descendants to get it, and he was not one of those descendants. Jacob was not. So Jacob is a wandering person. We read about him in Deuteronomy 26:5. You shall answer and say before the Lord your God, this is referred to a generic Jewish worshiper in connection with the first fruit offering. My father, Jacob, was a wandering Aramean, and he went down to Egypt and sojourned there. Few in number, but there he became a great, mighty, and populous nation. So even in Deuteronomy 26, Jacob is referred to as a sojourner, a wanderer. How did he wander? Well, he started out in, where did we first see him? Probably in Beersheba when he stole the birthright. Then he goes up to Bethel, then on to Padam Aram for 20 years, working for Rachel and Leah, and then to make a bunch of sheep, spotted and speckled and striped sheep. Came back to Mahanaim, double camp on the Jabbok River, and then he wrestled with the angel there at the Jabbok River. Then he moved toward Succoth, toward the Jordan River, crossed the Jordan River, went to Shechem. His sons, Simeon and Levi, offended all the Shechemites there by killing them, basically, because of the rape of Dinah. Then he goes south from Shechem, past Bethel, past Jerusalem, and he goes to Hebron. And then, of course, he's moved from Hebron on down to Egypt. So, yes, he's been a wanderer all of his life. Now, in verse 9, he gives his age. Well, first of all, he complains because he says that he has not attained the years that his fathers, the years of his fathers, the years that they attained to when they lived during the days of their sojourning. Well, let's compare. Abraham lived to 175. We see that in Genesis 25, verse 7. Isaac lived to 180. In Genesis 35, 28, we see that. Jacob is going to live 17 years after this, as we'll see in a minute. And so he dies at 147. So it's Abraham, 175, Isaac, 180, and Jacob, 147. So he's on the short end of the stick as far as longevity. Of course, pretty long from my point of view, but given the standards back then. And he says his years were few and unpleasant. That's a sad way to sum up your life, isn't it? This is the end result of his deceptive stealing of the birthright from Esau. He got the birthright by deception, but was it worth it? Look at what he had to go through. He had to flee from Esau, his brother, who was trying to kill him. He worked for 14 years for Laban in Padan Aram, Syria, Haran, probably Haran. That was his wife Rachel's brother who gypped him. He was supposed to work for 7 years. Laban gave him Leah instead of Rachel, and so he had to work for 7 more years. His daughter Dinah was raped at Shechem. He had to flee the Shechemites' revenge, which was provoked by Simeon and Levi's slaughter of the Shechemites. And then, right after that, he goes down, gets right around Bethlehem, heading back down to Hebron, and his beloved wife Rachel dies in childbirth. And, of course, after that, he thought that his beloved son Joseph was killed by wild beasts because his own sons lied to him, cheated him, and sold Joseph into slavery. So, yeah, he's had a hard life. He's had a real hard life. Few and unpleasant have been the years of his life, he says. We go now to Genesis 47, verses 11 and 12. So Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had ordered. Joseph provided his father and his brothers and all his father's household with food, according to their little ones. Now, Moses, writing this in verse 11, says this was the best of the land, Goshen. Even today, the NIV Study Bible says, Goshen is very fertile even as I speak. Now, James Fossen Brown said that this means it was the best land for pasture, not necessarily for crops, but I don't know if it's so green. I wonder why it wouldn't be the best land for growing crops, too. I don't want to understand why James Fossen Brown says that. But at any rate, it was the best land for shepherds and livestock and herds. Now, notice that Jacob's family had not had to pay a 20% grain tax during the fat years. They're receiving the benefit of what the Egyptians paid for. I say a tax. It's not really known for sure exactly how that worked. It could be a tax, 20% of all the grain during the fat years, or it could be that the Egyptians sold 20% of their grain to the Egyptians, the Egyptian government, or it could be that the Egyptian government took 20% of the grain but then compensated the Egyptians for it. So that's not really clear. But however it was done, the Hebrews had not had a thing to do with that. So they're coming and they're making hay off of what other people had given the government. Now that may have caused resentment later on, which would lead to the Jews' enslavement, as one website I read speculated. And of course that would assume that Egyptians weren't compensated for the 20% they gave away. Again, that's not clear. But if they had to have it taken from them and paid for at a price that might be below market, or if they had to pay a tax of 20%, they're not going to be happy with these Jews down here living off the fat of the land without having to sacrifice during the famine years. Now this land, the land of Goshen, is now called in verse 11, the land of Ramses. Now let me give you some other examples of where it's called that. Genesis 40, well, that's here, 47:11. Exodus 1:11. So they appointed taskmasters over them, that's the Egyptians, over the Israelites, to afflict them, to afflict the Israelites with hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithom and Ramses. There's the city, Ramses. Numbers 33, 3 through 5, they journeyed from Ramses in the first month. That's the first month of the Exodus. Dropping down to verse 5, Numbers 33, then the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses. All right, so why is it called Ramses, especially since Ramses wasn't alive at this time, during the time of Jacob? We're talking about what? I forgot the dates exactly, somewhere in the 19th century B.C., 1800s B.C. I just went to the internet to check my memory. I found a date here, 1910 B.C. to 1800 for Joseph, which is long after the 13th century when Ramses, long before the 13th century B.C. when Ramses I showed up. So we have an anachronism here. When Moses was writing about the 15th century B.C., he came about three centuries before Ramses, so obviously Moses had an editor of the transcript to change it, according as the NIV Study Bible says, to edit that. The name, the city of Ramses, is also called Zoan, Psalm 78:12. He wrought wonders before their fathers in the land of Egypt in the field of Zoan. Psalm 78:43. When he performed his signs in Egypt and his marvels in the field of Zoan. Same thing as Ramses. Same thing as the town of Ramses in the land of Goshen. Now Joseph provided food to his brothers' families according to their children. That means families with more children got more grain. There was enough grain for cattle in Goshen, but there wasn't enough to eat. And so Joseph gave them food from the Egyptian granaries. That's John Gill's idea. I don't know how he knows there wasn't enough grain for the cattle in Goshen. He speculates that. We go now to Genesis 47:13-15. Now there was no food in all the land because the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. Joseph gathered all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. When the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us food, for why should we die in your presence? For our money is gone." Now, verse 13, when it says there was no food in all the land, that means there was no food in private hands. For the people, the Egyptian government had grain stored, of course, under Joseph's charge. And in this situation, in this 7 years of famine, the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. The NIV says the land of Canaan wasted away. Now, all this money that Joseph was getting for this grain, he was making more money than he paid for the grain, so the government of Egypt was making money, but people never complained about the price because they were starving to death and they wanted the money. Plus, Joseph had to cover great expense to administer the food. He's ministering food to the whole country. He had to collect the grain. He had to preserve the grain. He had to distribute the grain. He had to handle the financing of the grain. He had to handle the bookkeeping, handle all that kind of stuff. Adam Clark has an interesting idea, which I disagree with. He says that Joseph had brought wheat in addition to the 20% that was taxes. He assumed that the 20% that people had to pay in the fat years was taxes, and then Joseph had bought up some more wheat, and then he was selling all the wheat that he had at the same price that he brought it up with. Well, all that speculation. Gill says he made profit even after covering his cost. Clark says, no, I broke even. Who knows? Note that it is disputed whether Joseph actually paid for the grain during the first 7 fat years. He could have just taken it as taxes, or he could have taken and then reimbursed for it, or he could have bought it on the open market. It's just hard to say. But at any rate, all the money was gone in Canaan, all the money that was in private hands. Now, when did all the people's money run out? Well, John Gill says it was probably the 5th year of the famine, and Jameson Fawcett and Brown says probably the 2nd year of the famine, which shows that nobody really knows when the money gave out, but it did. We go now to Genesis 47:16-17. Then Joseph said, "Give up your livestock, and I will give you food for your livestock, since your money is gone." So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for the horses and the flocks and the herds and the donkeys. And he fed them with food in exchange for all their livestock that year. Now Joseph said, "Give me your horses." So that means that the people in Egypt had horses. In fact, Egypt was famous for horses. We read in Deuteronomy 17:16. "Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, the king of Israel." Not the government of Israel. "Nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses." The Lord has said to you, "Shall never again return that way." You got out of Egypt, don't go back there. And you might be tempted to go back so you can breed some horses to multiply horses, because Egypt was famous for horses. Now we ask a question here. What could Joseph do with all the livestock that he's collecting for this grain? He had to pasture and feed that livestock in a time of drought. Well, John Gill says maybe the number of the livestock was all that, maybe it was not all that large, and that people were using livestock just to buy 1 year at a time, and so he could handle all the livestock. And my speculation is maybe the price for this grain was high, so that it took a lot of cattle to buy a little bit of grain, in which case we still got the problem of how Joseph can manage all this livestock. He's got to feed them. He's got to water them. He's got to watch out for them. It could be the number of livestock was low because a lot of livestock had died in the famine, and so Joseph could handle all the livestock that came in from the people. Now, here's a possible scenario as how this transfer of livestock to Jacob and the Egyptian government may have occurred, according to Adam Clark. Joseph could have bought the cattle with food because the cattle were starving. Thus, the people lived because they had grain to eat now, and the cattle lived because Joseph had grain to feed the cattle. Then after the famine, again, this is according to Adam Clark, after the famine, Joseph gives back the cattle that he had taken during the famine. And the reason we speculate, or the reason Clark speculates that Joseph did that, because if he didn't give the livestock back, there would be a national economic failure. No one would be able to till the fields. And notice that the people never complained about Joseph's doing. So we've got to read between the lines here and assume that Joseph eased their way, even as he was collecting money and fields. And in the next several verses, we're going to see he's even going to take their lands and their bodies. Genesis 47, 18 through 21, when that year was ended, 1 year of the famine, they came to him the next year and said to him, "We will not hide from my Lord that our money is all spent and the cattle are my Lord's. There is nothing left for my Lord except our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we and our land will be slaves to Pharaoh. So give us seed so that we may live and not die, and that the land may not be desolate." So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for every Egyptian sold his field, because the famine was severe upon them. Thus the land became Pharaoh's. As for the people, he removed them to the cities from one end of Egypt's border to the other. Now in verse 18, lands were transferred. Houses weren't mentioned, because John Gill says houses back then were of relative little worth compared to the land. And that makes sense. The houses are just adobe mud brick or whatever, but I'm not sure. But cheap, relatively cheap, but that land grew crops, and so it was more valuable. In verse 21, we read, "As for the people, he removed them to the cities." Joseph removed the people to the cities. That's the Masoretic text. The Septuagint, along with the Samaritan Pentateuch and the Vulgate, has it like the NIV Bible has it. Joseph reduced the people to servitude. In other words, instead of saying, "As the people, Joseph removed the people to the cities," rather, he reduced them to servitude. Now, that's a big, important difference in translation. We'll talk about that in a minute. Adam Clark and Jameson Fawcett and Brown point out that moving people to the cities would make it easier to do grain distribution because the people would be right there and they're concentrated, so it would be easy to get the grain to them. Note how the calamity led to increased government control and slavery, or at least it sounds like slavery. And so the question arises, should we condemn Joseph as a socialist? Well, I remember this question came up when I was at my seminary, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, from 1973 to 1975. And this was during, right after the hippie revolution, a bunch of left-wingers everywhere. And they were Christian socialists at my seminary, Jim Wallace, the Sojourners. And I remember they ran some kind of article in our Trinity newsletter talking about how wonderful socialism was, because after all, this wonderful man Joseph did it. And that sort of got me, and I replied in a letter to the editor or some sort such thing, and I said, "Well, yeah, socialism led to the slavery of the whole people. Is that what you want, Mr. Wallace? You want all of Americans to be slaves?" Well, that was a nice quick answer, but let's look at that a little bit deeper, because I just this morning found on the internet a economic right-wing Christian who was saying how horrible socialism was, and then he starts really damning Joseph, compared him to Joseph Stalin. He hated socialists, but he didn't think Joseph was such a good guy. Well, don't tell me that. Joseph was a good guy, a great guy. I think everybody agrees with that. So I thought this website, this blog, was a little bit off the beaten path. But here we have, in my experience, I've got a left-wing socialist and a right-wing anti-socialist capitalist, both saying that Joseph was a socialist. Well, now let's think about it. It sure sounds like it. I admit that. But let's look at some mitigating factors. First of all, hard cases make bad law. The situation was incredibly dire, and we all know that when in such situations, personal liberties always shrink. Remember in World War II how much freedom of speech you had? I'm sure that most of you were not around in World War I, but it's true. There was a huge curtailment of public speech, private speech, because of the war. How about COVID-19, the pandemic that we're going through now? We got government shutting people down. You can't even go make a living. Can't go to church. So that's what happens. And well, in the time of this famine, sure, the people lost a lot of their freedom, but that doesn't mean that you're a socialist, that Joseph was a socialist. Because here's another mitigating factor. There's no indication that the slavery of the people continued after the famine was over. Maybe they just moved back from the cities back to the countryside. They could have gotten their animals back. The 20% would have been just temporary during the 7 fat years, so they didn't have to pay more taxes, and things went back to the way they were before. Also, the slavery that's mentioned here in these verses was really just removing people from the countryside of the city so Joseph could administer the grain easier. They're all together. And Joseph could have taken the animals for the food so he could feed them to keep them alive, as I mentioned earlier, and he could have easily given them back when the famine was over. As again, if he hadn't given them back, there would be economic collapse in the 8th year, so he probably did that. And it could be that once the land started growing crops again and the people had to give 20% to the Pharaoh, as it says, well, it doesn't say in these verses, but earlier in Genesis 47, the people gave a fifth of the crops to Pharaoh. Maybe that's what happened again. After the famine was over, the people gave 20% of their crop, and after 5 years, they had bought the land back from Joseph, back from the government. Now, the text is not clear. In Genesis 47:24, at harvest, you're to give a fifth of it to Pharaoh. The text is not clear whether this is a buyback or perpetual rent that the people had to pay. So there's enough missing here where we can say, nah, Joseph wasn't a socialist. Genesis 47:22, only the land of the priest, he, Joseph, did not buy, for the priest had an allotment from Pharaoh, and they lived off the allotment which Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they did not sell their land. The priest did not buy for or because the priest had an allotment. They didn't need to buy because they had an allotment. And Adam Clark says that allotment is the earliest account of an established religion supported by the state. And oh boy, did the Egyptians love their religion, their state religion. The state and the church, well, not the church, but the state and the religion were inextricably intertwined. We go now to Genesis 47, verses 23 through 26. Then Joseph said to the people, behold, I have today bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now here is seed for you, and you may sow the land. At the harvest you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh. Okay, here's the fifth. I said it wasn't in the previous verse, but here it is here. At the harvest you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh. That's the same as it was during the fat times. Now after the famine is over, we're back to fat times again, and the people were still supposed to give a fifth to Pharaoh. And four-fifths shall be your own seed, and four-fifths shall be your own for seed of the field, and for your food, and for those of your household, and as food for your little ones. So they said, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's slaves. Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, valid to this day. That's the day of Moses when he writing in the 15th century B.C. Made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, valid to this day, that Pharaoh should have the fifth. Only the land of the priest did not become Pharaoh's. That's because they didn't need to give their land to the Pharaoh. He gave them a special deal. So this fifth was continued to pay for Pharaoh. But again, that could have been rent, showing that the Pharaoh had taken the land over forever and ever, or it could just be a buyback provision. So after 5 years, you get the land back. Adam Clark says that before all this land ended up in Pharaoh's account, it seems that Egypt had a very limited monarchy before the famine. Pharaoh, priest, and people all had their separate estates. Ah, but then not so much after the famine. Now let's see what Clark says about Joseph. He does not compare Joseph to Joseph Stalin. Quote, the whole of this conduct of Jesus has been as strongly censored by some. See, that's what I was just telling you. Even back in the 1800s, people were getting on Joseph's case about what he did. Censored by some, as it has been as strongly censored by some as applauded by others. It is natural for men to run into extremes in attacking or defending any position. Sober and judicious men will consider what Joseph did by divine appointment as a prophet of God and what he did merely as a statesman from the circumstances of the case, the complexion of the times, and the character of the people over whom he presided. When this is dispassionately done, we shall see much reason to adore God, applaud the man, and perhaps in some cases, censor the minister. In other words, Joseph might have done okay. He did very well, but on some cases you can't say he did everything all right. So on a case-by-case basis, we'll look at what Joseph did. Joseph is never held up to our view as an unerring prophet of God. He was an honored instrument in the hands of God, saving two nations from utter ruin, and especially of preserving that family from which the Messiah was to spring, and of perpetuating the true religion among them. In this character, he's represented in the sacred pages. His conduct as the prime minister of Pharaoh was powerfully indicative of a deep and consummate politician who had high notions of prerogative, which led him to use every prudent means to aggrandize his master, and at the same time to do what he judged best on the whole for the people he governed. So that's pretty good praise from Adam Clark. Why was this fifth that was owed by the people to Pharaoh? Why was it mentioned here? It was already true before, as we said, during the fat years before the famine. So why mention it again here after the famine? Well, it could be that people were expecting that 100% of that land would belong to Pharaoh, and they're not going to get four-fifths of it. They'd become Pharaoh's slaves. So Joseph is showing graciousness here. They asked for seed in verse 24. That would be seed for the harvest for the next year. So I'm assuming it could be. This is the seventh year of famine. The seed is for the next year, the eighth year, the first year of renewed plenty. Now there's something that might be seen as a contradiction here. In verse 24, we read that Joseph says to the people, four-fifths shall be your own for seed of the field and for your food. So they got seed for the next year as well as food to eat this year. Now the fact that they were planting in the field has led some to think that maybe this is a contradiction with Genesis 47:21. As for the people, he removed them to the cities from one end of Egypt's border to the others. So they're planting in the fields here and paying 20%, and in Genesis 47, the people are removed to the city. So how do you reconcile those two verses? John Gill suggests option number one, there was an intent to remove the people to the cities, but it wasn't carried out. And so they all ended up in the fields growing, planting seeds. I don't believe that. It could be option number two. Joseph called all the people to the cities to inform them that their lands and persons would belong to Pharaoh. So that way you have the people out in the fields planting the seeds, as our scripture here says. And then the people go to the cities so that Joseph could inform them about the new arrangements as far as the 20% every year. I don't really believe those are two good options to reconcile how they were planting in the fields and living in the cities. This is the best way, in my humble opinion. The planting and the harvesting referred to in our verse here refers to the eighth year, the first year after the famine. They go back from the cities, back into the fields to plant, but they were in the cities during the 7 years of the famine. Now, in verse 26, the scripture says that Joseph made it a statute, the paying of 20%. Concerning the land of Egypt, valid to this day. Of course, that's the day that Moses wrote in the 15th century B.C. We go now to Genesis 47, verse 27. Now, Israel lived in the land of Egypt. Now, that's not Jacob Israel. That's the people of Israel. Lived in the land of Egypt in Goshen, and they acquired property in it and were fruitful and became very numerous. This fruitfulness and this numeric increase shows the fulfillment of God's promises to Jacob. We read in Genesis 35:11-12, God also said to him, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply. Fruitful, there's the same word, fruitful. And multiply, that means become numerous. And we see that happening in Genesis 47:27. The people in Goshen became fruitful and became very numerous. And so God's promise to Jacob in Genesis 35:11-12 became true. God continued there in Genesis 35, a nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come forth from you. The land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give it to you, and I will give the land to your descendants after you. Of course, that occurred after the Exodus as far as the land, but the people were being multiplied down there in Egypt. We read also in Genesis 46, the previous chapter, verse 3. This is when God is speaking to Jacob, trying to get him to go back to Egypt so he won't starve to death in the famine in Canaan. God said, I am God, the God of your father, God of Jacob's father he's talking to Jacob. I am the God of your father, the father being Isaac. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. So the promise has been fulfilled here in Genesis 47:27. And of course, these promises of a great nation, of a numerous offspring and seed, that was one aspect of the famous promise to Abraham, land, offspring, seed, if you want to translate it that way, and blessing. Well, the offspring were being produced in Goshen, in Egypt. Just to remind ourselves of this great promise, Genesis 12:2, God says to Abraham, I will make you, Abraham, a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. A great nation. Genesis 26:24, the Lord appeared to him, Isaac. Genesis 12 was when Abraham set off from Haran to the promised land. Genesis 26 is after the attempted sacrifice of Isaac on Mount Moriah. Genesis 26:24, the Lord appeared to Isaac the same night and said, I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants. There's the great nation. As a matter of fact, the Israelites went from 70 people going down to Egypt to 600,000 when they left. Genesis 46:27, it says those who came to Egypt were 70. Actually, it was 66, but the house of Jacob that went down to Egypt was 70. 66 went because Ur and Onan were dead, and Ephraim and Manasseh were born in Egypt. So maybe technically we should say 66. And we know in the Exodus 12:37, now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth, about 600,000 men. And that's just the men, apart from the children. So you see, a great nation was created down there in Egypt, just like God had promised to Jacob when he went down there with those 66 people. We go down to Genesis 47:28-30. Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, so the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. When the time for Israel, that's Jacob, when the time for Israel to die drew near, he called his son Joseph and said to him, please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me in Egypt. But when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And he said, I will do as you have said. Now Jacob living in Egypt 17 years, that's the same. He lived with Joseph in Egypt the same number of years he lived with Joseph in Canaan, because Joseph was 17 years when he left Canaan and so was sold into slavery to Egypt. I don't know why that's of great importance. That sounds like a trivia question to me. Now, Jacob asked Joseph to put Joseph's hand on Jacob's thigh in order to swear this oath. Why on the thigh? This is not the first time we've seen this. It's close to the organ of procreation. I remember Abraham got Eliezer, his servant, to put his hand under Abraham's thigh. Well, the NIV Study Bible says the purpose of this is that the hand is thus placed close to the organ of procreation. That's your, to use the Chinese, the Yingjing. And that was to emphasize the desire to continue the seed of Abraham, as the NIV Study Bible points out. Now, Jacob wanted to be buried in Canaan. Why? Because he had a romantic attachment to the soil of his native land? No. It was rather from faith in the promises of God to Abraham. Land, offspring, and blessings. Well, land means the land of Canaan. That was the promised land, and so that's where Jacob wanted to be buried. He wanted to be buried more particularly in the land of his fathers, the cave of Machpelah, in their burial place. That was the cave of Machpelah, which was in a field near the Oak of Mamre, which was in Hebron, which was where Isaac had been buried. Abraham and Sarah had been buried there. So now we go to Genesis 47:31. He, that's Jacob, said, swear to me, he's talking to Joseph, his son, swear to me, so he, Joseph, swore to him, swore to Jacob. Then Israel bowed in worship at the head of the bed. So Joseph has made a solemn vow to get Jacob's body back up to Canaan. And we'll see that the brothers did take him back up there to bury him at Hebron, near in the cave of Machpelah. But there's one little interesting point here, translation point. Then Israel bowed in worship at the head of the bed. The NIV has Israel worshiped as he leaned on the top of his staff. But then the NIV has a note, bed. So in other words, there's a translation problem between staff and bed, a translation alternative. And we see in Hebrews 11:21, the author of Hebrews is referring to this verse and says this, by faith Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning on the top of his staff. Well, I don't know which way it is. To me, it makes more sense to say staff, even though the King James has bowed himself upon the bed's head. Whatever that means, it just means if you say he's leaned on the top of his staff, he's just leaning over. He's an old man and he's worshiping God while he's doing it. That's the easiest way to take it. If it's bed, well, then I guess he is lying in his bed and he's worshiping at the head of the bed, which means that he's probably propped up at the bed's head praying to God. I don't know. Doesn't really matter. Now, let's ask a more important question. Why did Jacob say, Joseph, swear to me, swear to me? Does he not trust Joseph? I don't trust you, Joseph, to get my body back up to Canaan. So you got to swear by Almighty God. You've got to swear that God will strike you dead if you don't get my body up there. That's kind of what it sounds like. But this, he was not really doing that to show distrust in Joseph. He was not saying, swear, 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 because I don't trust you, Joseph. He was rather trying to show his eagerness. I really want to go back to Egypt. I really want to go back to Canaan. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished chapter 47 of Genesis. In our next audio, we will turn to Genesis 48. We'll do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 22, and we will see Joseph blessing his two sons by Asenath, his wife, Ephraim, and Manasseh. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoy this one.